I'm Capri Cafaro, host of Eat Your Heartland Out. We are visiting Amish country in the Midwest. We go beyond buggies and bonnets to get an authentic understanding of the Amish and Mennonite communities.
Eat Your Heartland Out, coming up tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we have horticulturist Ron Smith to answer lawn and garden questions. We are going to start, though, with a creature we would love to see in our lawns and gardens, and that is the monarch butterfly. We are visiting today with filmmaker Deb Walwerk. She is the creative force behind a film that is going to be showing on Prairie Public's television service coming up on September 23rd. It is called The Butterfly Effect. Deb, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's wonderful to be here.
Why did you want to do a film on the monarch butterfly?
Well, I had recently moved to Fergus Falls. I actually landed in Fergus Falls, kind of like the Wizard of Oz. It was because of a tornado in Minneapolis, or straight line winds came through, tore the roof off the apartment building that I was in, and I was up here in Lake Country. And when I found this out, and water came streaming down the walls, and my cabin is not too far from Fergus, from the Caddis Gallery, and the gallery director there offered me, they have an artist's housing above the Caddis, and she said, you know, there's an empty one here. Why don't you just move your stuff here? And, you know, this can be your base for the rest of the summer. And so I ended up in Fergus Falls, and I really love Fergus. But Fergus is in the middle of the flyway. We're all in the middle of the flyway, the monarch flyway. They're flying right now from Canada and through this area roosting. I think maybe we're a little bit, maybe 10 days ago, maybe most of them are gone, I think, at this point. But a lot of butterflies come through here. And so the Fergus Falls has Prairie Wetlands Learning Center, which has a monarch tagging program. And what happened was is that I opened the New York Times one morning, and it said that the scientists were really, really concerned about, because there had been a 90% loss of butterflies in the two decades before this was, I think, 2014, but there was a 90% loss of the butterflies in the sanctuaries in Mexico that winter. It snowed in the mountains of Mexico, which are, you know, the monarchs are
That's rare because
it's very temperate.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there was really concern that monarchs wouldn't recover. And that occurred at the same time that other studies done at the Monarch Lab at the University of Minnesota were saying, you know, the real problem here, it's not the deforestation in Mexico, which people had thought was the problem. It's the loss of milkweed in that main corridor, the middle corridor of the United States.
And that's a plant that is important to them, because that is, as far as I know, the only plant that they lay their eggs on, right?
That's exactly it. You know, we think of the monarch as a backyard butterfly. We think because it gets nectars from the flowers in our backyard, but it's actually a prairie, a native prairie insect, and it requires milkweed to lay its eggs on. So every butterflies have host plants, and the monarch is kind of unique in that the milkweed is its only host plant. Mm-hmm. So it's very dependent on being able to find milkweed.
What is it about the milkweed plant that is so attractive to the butterfly, to the monarch?
You know, it's attractive to a lot of insects. And once you start allowing milkweed to grow in your backyard, because often it springs up there, it is a weed after all. It's got a milky sap, and that sap is actually toxic to birds and particularly birds, but it's toxic enough that other animals won't eat a full-grown monarch. Those orange and black colors that it's mm-hmm. flashing at you are mm-hmm. actually a warning sign that say, don't eat me.
They're so beautiful.
So it gets both nourishment and this protective chemical.
Oh, that makes sense that milkweed. It would be for safety reasons that they would choose the milkweed. Where is milkweed most common?
It's a prairie plant, and it grows out on the open prairie. And okay. pretty much you see it a lot in ditches now because it's at the edges. As farmers have cultivated the land, we've gone to where we still have kind of wild land in the edges, and that's where you'll find milkweed. It's in the ditches or it's okay. at the edges of fields. It needs the sunlight. It can't survive in the woods. So,
is most of the threat behind the monarch population numbers? Is it related to that changeover from prairie to cropland and the loss of the milkweed, or is it more about the climate change?
That's
and the
exactly
temperatures?
It. I mean, there's several factors. You know, I mean, there's a lot of factors, but in 2014, when the scientists did these studies, that's what they identified at that point was the most challenging problem was the loss of milkweed. And so the University of Minnesota has a monarch lab, and they've been working on various projects. They worked on they wanted to have a monarch corridor. I-35 was going to be the monarch corridor. And because that's another place, the byways and of highways are another place where you can plant a lot of native plants. Mm. I mean, there's a lot of acreage there that's not dedicated to anything else. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of their big ideas. But what became the most – the idea that really blossomed was – and that people just started to plant milkweed and plant the other native plants, the nectar plants, in their gardens. And so really habitat for monarchs has kind of moved out of the prairie and into our gardens.
Okay. Yeah, I was wondering when it comes to this kind of process, you know, there's different levels of involvement. There's sort of the individual level, what I can do on my garden that I either can own on land or that I could rent space for. There's what the farmers can do with their large swaths of land. And then there's things like you just mentioned in the municipalities, in the cities.
Yes.
And I wonder, do you have a sense of one level of involvement? Which one would you really go for, that individual, that consumer, that farmer, or that city level?
You know, I'm living in Minneapolis at the moment, and you'd be amazed at how many people have just allowed milkweed to grow or gotten milkweed seeds and allowed milkweed to grow in their gardens. And that's becoming a very popular – but a larger landscape solution is really important. What I'd really love to see is I'd – love to see more hunting land and the wildlife management areas. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see those. I think we have a commitment to those those areas do have a commitment to wildlife, and it's just a matter of getting more seeds and more native plants out there. But yeah, I'd love to see that. But you know what? What seems to be more exciting to people is just the idea, you know, we grow flowers. You can grow butterflies, and all you need are the host plants for the butterflies. And so in my yard at the lake, it's kind of – I kind of had this – the opposite experience of most people, which is I was very aware of prairie restorations, and I learned a lot about prairies way back in the late 80s and 90s because there was a huge kind of awareness, all of a sudden, just out of the blue, people said, wait a minute, here's an ecology that's, you know, practically disappeared and we've totally overlooked it. And so I got involved at the Nature Conservancy, did some seed collecting programs here in North Dakota where they'd go to these little areas that, you know, farmers hadn't plowed or whatever it was and collect seeds. So I was very aware, and I knew about coneflowers, you know, echinacea, which are beautiful, and they're wonderful garden plants. And so I bought, because the cabin that I bought didn't really have much, you know, plant gardening space. There was nothing there. So I planted a lot of coneflowers, and I really love blazing stars, and that's another monarch attractor. And strangely enough, for me, the milkweeds started popping up in my garden. So I started getting butterflies. I've gotten a little more conscientious. You know, you can attract swallowtails, and you can attract admirals. I get a lot of red admirals, and it's probably because this is a plant that people don't necessarily like, but it's a host plant for red admirals, and that's the nettles. And then painted ladies. There's a lot of painted ladies around too, and I don't remember what their host plant is. But monarchs are the only ones that migrate.
Okay. We're visiting today with Deb Walwerk about her film The Butterfly Effect, which will be airing on September 23rd on Prairie Public's television service. And Deb, the title, The Butterfly Effect, okay. I think there's probably the double meaning on that, right?
Yes.
So the butterfly effect, sure, this is the effect that butterflies can have on the landscape, but go deeper into that double meaning.
So I was curious. I was talking to someone, and they were talking to me about the butterfly effect in physics, and this is actually a much more complex scientific concept that I'm going to be able to explain. But basically, it means that when a very small action can actually create a tidal wave of actions, and it is often when that action is multiplied by the next thing, and that thing is multiplied by the next thing, and that's multiplied by the next thing. But that's kind of what we've seen in the gardens of the prairie, is this multiplication effect, where we really are bringing the monarch back, you know, one milkweed at a time.
Where did the funding come from to make this film?
The funding came from the Lake Region Arts Council. Okay. I got a legacy grant from the Minnesota State Legislature. And that was another reason that I was kind of fortunate to be in this area, because those grants are available to artists and filmmakers here.
What's the process of getting your film out on something like Prairie Public and screenings to people? I should know the answer about how to get a movie shown on Prairie Public, but I don't. I work in radio.
Well, it's a wild world out there in the world of distribution, and you know, it's hard to know which direction to go in many ways. But I come from television. I was a producer, and I did projects in affiliation with Prairie Public, and I also have had a lot of my work broadcast on TPT, on Twin Cities Public Television. And so it's just natural for me. I remember I got a postcard from a friend of mine one time after a film of mine had shown, and he said, 40,000 eyeballs. So he was looking at the Nielsen ratings or something. Apparently 40,000 people had watched
that. That's lovely.
So, you know, you can collect 100 people in a, you know, at the Fargo Theater. You can reach a lot more people. And the television is a genre, you know. It's a unique genre. I was always told, you know, in television, people can always walk away, and they can go to the fridge, they can go to the couch, they can, you know, they can go, you know. So people rarely watch a television show all the way through from beginning to end. It's not a movie theater,
right,
you know.
Yeah.
And so you have to, you know, I almost said writing, but there's writing, editing, mm-hmm. and the whole visual aspect of making films. Mm-hmm. You work with a lot faster pace in television because mm-hmm. you want to draw people in and then you want to hold them
yeah.
there.
You have about 7 seconds to get their attention. Yeah.
That's right.
So the writing, the editing, the researching, the filming, are you doing all of that by yourself?
That was my proposal to Lake Region Arts Council. I said, you know what? There are television cameras. There are broadcast quality cameras. You know, can I do this?
Yeah.
Can I do this as a one-person unit? And but I actually had a good friend, Janet Bayless, who okay. came out on a bunch of the shoots with me, served as a second camera. And she's an experimental filmmaker. Her mm. her background is in Fargo here, too.
Okay.
She's a FOSS. But she has been doing these wonderful little experimental films for years and years and years and years. And so I just embedded those in the program. And there, her daughter is releasing a butterfly. And she did all the slow-mo, the where you see the caterpillar turn into
yeah.
A into chrysalis. And then yeah. the chrysalis, the butterfly emerged from the chrysalis. Janet did all that work.
Okay.
So it was really wonderful to work with her because it just was – it's so much more fun to have somebody that you're kind of going back and forth with and getting
yeah.
excited about the things that they're sending you. Yeah.
Well, and I noticed another Prairie Public name on the credits, Les Scorapat, who is our longtime art designer here
oh,
at Prairie
one of the
Public.
Best in
he
the
is.
Whole country. Yeah.
He is. Yeah, and he's
Les
been here
wonderful.
For – I think more than 40 years. So yeah. long time dedication to Prairie Public and to the arts like this. What was his role?
He did the cover. And then there's a wonderful little animation of the title mm-hmm. that Les was involved in helping out with.
Okay. Yeah, that was fun to see.
Yeah.
Because you used to work here at Prairie Public. Is that
I
right?
I did,
okay.
yes. I had an unusual relationship with Prairie Public, but yes, I worked here. I was a TV camera person, and I was the girl Friday. I did all kinds of stuff. I wrote grants. I did development. I did anything anyone wanted to pay me for. I was available for
wear all the hats. What are some of the most exciting changes that you have seen in filmmaking since your days doing camera operating here to, you know, now you can shoot a film on an iPhone and you can edit it there too?
Yeah. Well, I've always been someone who loves the documentary form, mm-hmm. and that has just exploded in creativity. You know, there's a lot of animation now that's used in documentary to present kind of concepts that you can't just, you know, film from actuality. And there's a lot of interesting just the way people are structuring things and editing things. I mean, it's really developed as an art form, and it's really fun to mm-hmm. see the editing is a lot quicker, and there's just a yeah. lot more creative creative yeah. energy put into how things are jump cuts all over the place
yeah.
and all kinds of stuff, you know, just to keep the viewer engaged. So.
Yeah. No, I know my sister will send me videos of her son just like raking the yard, but they're edited and they, you know, she's color corrected and like, wow, this is incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible the things you can do on your phone.
I was reading about some of the other projects and films that you have been involved with. What's trash fashion?
Trash fashion. So another thing I'm really fascinated by in the Fergus Falls area is they are doing a lot with the, what is it called, solid waste. Otter Tail County Solid Waste has an education director, Cedar Walters, and she's doing amazing projects with people in the community. So Fergus kind of considers itself an arts community.
Yeah.
And she has an arts degree from Perpich. She went to the Perpich Arts High in Minneapolis. She's from this area. But first they had artisan residence, and they're still doing that through Springboard for the Arts. Michelle Anderson brings in these artists for residencies, and she invited them out to the Solid Waste Center, and they started working with trash. And now they have a precious plastics lab there where they're taking plastic and recycling it into a material for artists to use. And they're going to use glass. They just are starting up a facility where they're going to use glass, recycle the glass into roadways. And so anyway, trash fashion was...
You can drive on that?
Yeah, apparently. Okay. I'd love to know more about
that.
Are
the flat tire repair people in on this?
I know. I'd love to know more. I just saw that in the newspaper, and that Cedar was quoted, you know, talking about being part of bringing that about. But she did a fashion show, a trash fashion show, and she engaged artists in coming up with a dress or outfit of some kind. They were all women models, but dresses made out of whatever material they could get from the recycling center that they were, you know, that they were throwing out at home. And it was really, really fun, and they had the whole catwalk in at a place called The Spot, and it was also a competition. They only gave something like 4 hours. You had to plan beforehand, and they gave you studio space to do it. And there were just these wonderful. there was a wonderful girl who everything was made out of bird seed. You know, the bags that are left over. Mm. And just this, she had a nest on the top of her head.
That's incredible.
And then there was one where it was all fringe. You know, it was this wonderful fringe. So when she lifted her arms, that looked like wings that were made out of plastic bags, you know, shopping bags. And yeah, they were gorgeous and feathery. And so it was really fun. And I did a short little piece about that.
I would be nervous to expose just how many bags of chips I eat if I had to make something out of my own bag. I've got
chip
a
bags.
Real weakness.
They were one of the artist's favorite material because they're so shiny and colorful.
Well, hey, anyone out there making a trash dress, you need some shiny, crunchy chip bags. I'm your girl. Deb, what are you working on next?
I am actually this weekend. I've been coordinating a NIBI walk, and NIBI is the Ojibwe word for water. Mm. And I met a woman at the Hennepin Theater Trust. They tried to gather artists who were interested in doing something about climate change, and Sharon was one of the presenters. And it's a ceremony. I mean, it's such an incredible thing that these NIBI walks where it's an extended ceremony and it's a prayer for water. And she takes water from the source of the river and then brings it to the mouth and then pours it in the mouth to remind the river, you know, how pure it was at the source. And she's done it on the Mississippi and she's done it on the Missouri and she's done it on the Red. And we're going to be doing a walk on the Otter Tail this Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, starting up at Elbow Lake Village on the White Earth Reservation. And if people are interested in that, they can look for Honor the Otter Tail Facebook page.
Filmmaker Deb Walwerk and her film The Butterfly Effect airs September 23rd on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ashley. This was a lot of fun.
Still to come on Main Street, horticulturist Ron Smith. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The North Dakota Director for the Small Business Administration says he's bullish on small businesses, even though the economy has been going through some tough times due to the COVID-19 pandemic.
SBA's mission is to help small businesses start, grow, expand, and recover from natural disasters.
Alan Hout says SBA can help through counseling services as well as guaranteed loan programs, or the agency works with local lenders helping them provide financing to small businesses.
Over the last couple of years, our loan volume has actually gone up, and especially within this year, our volume, we're on track to have our best year in probably 5 or 6 years. thanks to the support of our local lenders, our community banks and credit unions, and the small businesses that are looking for opportunities to start, grow, and expand their operations.
Hout says businesses also took advantage of federal coronavirus relief money, such as the Paycheck Protection Program administered by SBA. Developers of a proposed carbon dioxide pipeline are seeking support from some Minnesota county officials. It's part of a project to link ethanol plants in five states. The pipeline would impact 10 Minnesota counties who would have to approve it before it can be built. Jesse Harris is a spokesperson for Iowa-based Summit Carbon Solutions.
The vision for this project is that we would be able to capture CO2 emissions at participating ethanol facilities, compress those emissions, place it into a pipeline, transport to North Dakota, where it would be stored permanently and safely underground.
Capturing CO2 would allow the ethanol plants to sell fuel to states with low carbon fuel standards, meaning a larger market and higher prices for that ethanol. The company hopes to have that pipeline operational by 2024. And Minnesota is expanding an energy assistance program to help people pay water and sewer bills. The Minnesota Energy Assistance Program already helps income-eligible people with home heating, home cooling, and electricity costs. Now the State Commerce Department is using $15 million in federal COVID relief funds to help prevent people from being disconnected from water and sewer utilities. Program Director Michael Schmitz says since the pandemic began, a growing number of Minnesotans have been unable to afford their utility bills.
There is definitely concern that more and more people have not been able to pay their bills over the past year plus, and that more people are facing disconnections than ever.
Minnesotans can apply for both energy and water assistance with the same application. The guidelines say a family of four can earn up to $67,000 a year and still qualify. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them, in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Hi, Peter Sagal here, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Prairie Public is celebrating 40 years of radio, and they have invited me to zoom in on the party to play Not Dave's Job with news director Dave Thompson. Did I say yes? Of course I did. Zooming. It's fun. Join us Saturday, September 25th at the Radisson in Bismarck. Get your tickets at prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-6900. Congratulations, Dave and Prairie Public, for 40 outstanding years serving the great people of North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg in studio with horticulturist Ron Smith. It is time to talk about lawn and garden issues. Ron, thanks for joining us
today. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what is the latest on drought?
Drought.
We did have some good rain on the eastern part of the state anyway.
Yeah, 35 hundredths of an inch in my backyard rain gauge, and it looked wonderful to see the rain coming down and see the soil well saturated. So that's a big help for those of us that got it. As far as drought across the rest of the state, it's not doing very well. And the further west you get into Montana and Idaho and places like that, they're having problems with shortness of crops, crops not producing what they should. And so we're going to see some higher prices on grass seed next spring, because what they harvest now, they'll go ahead and run a test, a germination test on it. And then when you buy your seed in the spring of 2022, you're going to see tested in February of 2022. So that's what you want to buy, of course, is the most current crop of seed, because it's the freshest seed. But if you paid, let's say, $5 for 5 pounds, which is ridiculous, of grass seed, expect it to at least double in price, if not more, because some of it's, so the bluegrass is coming up very, very short, and so is the fine fescue. But the fine fescue is a cheaper grass to go ahead and grow overall. So they're trying to get more and more of the fine leaf fescue into these mixes or these blends that they have for the typical home lawn person. And there's nothing wrong with that, because I have a fine fescue Kentucky bluegrass backyard myself, and it grows very, very nicely, makes a nice dense turf. So whatever you're going to be doing as far as seeding goes, try to get it done this fall and take advantage of the harvest of 20, the seed that was tested this 2021, and you'll see it on the label.
Okay.
There, and that'll be
because it'll likely be more expensive.
Yeah. Expect it to go up just like everything else is doing these days.
Okay. Well, isn't there an advantage to seeding in the fall, too, in that there's less competition?
If I had my checkbook, I'd write you a check for asking that question.
I mean, we can pause.
You're so good at asking questions, and that's great.
It's kind of my job.
Yeah, you do it very well. Anyhow, yes, there is an advantage to it. You have less competition from weeds. Lower competition, I should say, from weeds. And you have cooler nights.
Mm-hmm.
The grass seedlings that are going to be emerging from our fall seeding, I should say, are not going to have to face the 95-degree heat that we faced immediately after Memorial Day weekend, which is tough on the grass no matter how much you water. You have these little fuzzy-faced seedlings coming up, and they're going to go through a lot of stress to try to get established, and you're going to get poor establishment. I've seen lawns that people thought were dormant actually be dead, D-E-A-D, and all the water in the world is not pulling them back. So where your lawn is dead and it has not responded to our rains, then you need to go ahead, get in there and scratch it up. If it's just a small area or relatively small areas, scratch it up and then put the seed down and then just incorporate it into the topsoil that's there and put some water to it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do water this fall, water infrequently and deeply. And take your time to let the water soak in, and it'll be there in reserve. Just like farmers want good rain, water profile in their soil for next spring to have their crops grow, we want it the same way for our turf grass.
Okay. And how infrequent is infrequently? Once a week?
About once a week, depending on the kind of weather we have. And, of course, the cooler the weather is, the less of a critical thing it is to have water down there.
Oh, sure.
But you do want to have some moisture there. So you don't want to have if you're reseeding, you want to go ahead and get that seed to pop and germinate. And your seed mixtures are going to have some perennial ryegrass in it. And if you can go ahead and put some light frequent irrigations down and three or four minutes per station or in the areas that you've reseeded, that perennial ryegrass will sprout in about a week. You'll see the little grass seedlings coming up. And when you see that, then you can back off and start watering maybe once a week, once every 10 days, depending on the temperatures that we have and everything else.
And generally speaking, how late is too late in the year to start seeding? Like, can you do it through the first or second week of October?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And the further you get into October, the more likely it's going to be considered a dormant seeding.
Okay.
In other words, you might not see as much germination taking place depending on the weather, but that seed will remain viable there. The cold weather will actually hold it at that point of beginning to germinate, is becoming active to go ahead and go through the germination process.
Okay.
So when it comes up next spring we get the right weather, poof, it pops and grows very nicely.
Now, you mentioned the price of grass seed going up in the spring because of this drought. And I know years ago there used to be things like clover mixed into grass seed mixes. Has there been any talk about other plants that are more drought tolerant but that have similar sort of growing profiles to grass being added back in?
If it hasn't fallen on my ears yet because clover has been declared such an enemy to nice uniform grass. We Americans have fallen in love, and sometimes rightly so, with a beautiful green lawn. And there are people out there that want to have that nice estate look, and the nice estate look can only be had with a nice smooth sweep of grass. If it's mowed properly, it'll look wonderful. If it's mowed at about 3 inches plus, maybe 3.5 inches, it'll look absolutely beautiful, even in hot weather. You still have to water it every now and then if it's a bluegrass lawn. But if you start having clumps of clover in there, the clover is going to bear flowers. The flowers are going to attract bees. And if you have kids out there in bare feet running around, they step on a bee or get close to a bee, they could get stung, and that's not a good thing. So the big advantage with an all grass lawn and no clover is you don't have to worry about there being a bee problem. And bees are not a problem. They don't pay any attention to you. They only get aggressive when they get disturbed. And so Have you ever stuck, you've seen a bee in a flower?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You stick your finger down there and just see if the bee will come over to it. He'll probably land on it, check you out. Ah, you're not a flower, and it'll fly away. But if you go and swat at it, bingo, you're going to get a stinger.
Yeah. Yeah, I got a hornet after me.
Oh, no, you don't want that. That's terrible.
What are the general rules right now for mowing the lawn?
Mow tall and let it fall, okay? Between now and we get into colder weather and shorter days, when is that day going to come when we fall behind? Is it this next week, the 21st or something like that? Yeah, something, whenever it is.
Isn't that the first Sunday in November?
No, I think it's sometime in September or early October. Anyhow.
Yeah, my cell phone just does it for me, so.
The grass doesn't know the difference as far as hours go. But the thing that's good is that the grass rate, you get a lower and lower clipping yield as we get further into the season. And that's not a bad thing. The grass is slowing down. But as you mow, keep it high. Don't try to lower it down to get more grass clippings.
Mm-hmm.
Keep it high until you get to the last mowing. And if you're predicting snow the next day or later this week or freezing, 25-degree temperatures, whatever, that's going to stop the grass from growing. And we're into October then go ahead and drop it an inch, mow and collect. Okay, just mow it and collect it and take it into recycling or put it into a compost pile.
Okay. All right, solid. What is the difference, Ron? You said that you want to talk about mulching around trees.
And you
mentioned stone mulch and organic mulch.
Yes.
Stone, I guess, is just that's putting rocks around
stone,
your trees?
Yes, it is. And that's unfortunately become a very popular thing, not only here in North Dakota, but across the country. And if you go far enough east in this country, into Pennsylvania and New Jersey, you're going to see recycled rubber tire chips used as a mulch around there. And it's terrible. I don't even want to get into the negatives on it. I'll eat up the time. So stone mulch does absolutely nothing good for the tree or the shrubs that you have it in. Okay. It's a heat island. It doesn't decompose. It locks itself together. Okay. In other words, you have the stone piled up here and you get dust blowing in and it becomes almost like a concrete surface there.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get a lot of air and water movement through that. As I said, it's a heat island, and you're not going to get moisture going through as well as you would with an organic mulch. Now, I've heard people complain. I had a lady complain to me last week about Fran. I go for it, but the stuff blows around. You can get bark nuggets or shredded bark that has some tackifier in it, or you can get the tackifier and spray it on. It's not going to be like glue or anything.
What is tackifier?
Tackifier.
What is that?
It's an organic material that kind of gives a little bit of cohesion to the grass, or excuse me, the shredded bark staying together.
Okay.
So if we get a 50-mile-an-hour wind, it's going to blow.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to blow with our normal winds around here, 25 to 30 miles an hour. It'll stay pretty stable. Mulch does everything, organic mulch does everything that you want it to do. It breaks down. It keeps the roots cool. It nourishes the soil because as it breaks down, it releases the nutrients that it has there that would do the tree itself some good.
Mm.
As you know, as a tree matures, the root system spreads out. You can make that mulched area as big as you want to, or you just keep it around the tree, not up against the trunk of the tree. And it should be basically on a 3x3x3 basis, 3 feet wide with a freshly planted tree, the bark 3 inches away from the trunk of the tree, and the bark 3 inches thick. Don't make a mulch volcano. I'm sure you've seen those where people get in this. It's beautiful to look at, but it's not doing the tree any good. And if I was a little vole or a mouse or even a little bunny, I'd hide in that stuff. That's great stuff to hide in. And you also have a nice little meal there at the base of the tree to nibble on during the winter months.
So but stay you want to pull it away from the tree.
Yeah, pull it away 3 inches at least around the trunk of the tree.
Okay.
And so I can't speak highly enough about the organic mulch that you should go ahead and use. It's a lot easier to handle. It doesn't get as hot. You don't get a hot heat island.
Mm-hmm.
And for heaven's sakes, don't put a plastic or impervious cover underneath that to go ahead and have it to keep it neat. They both get weeds in them. Both of them will have weed seed blow in, and you'll have the weeds there to contend with. With stone, you can try to pull it out, but it'll probably break the weeds off because of the root system has gone down in there. What you can do then is hit that with, if you have a stone mulch, you have to hit it with an herbicide like Roundup. With organic mulch, they root in the mulch and they pop out very, very easily.
Okay.
So it's much easier to go ahead and manage.
So if you're deciding between stone and organic mulch on the tree, the good question to ask is, am I doing this for the tree's sake or for my sake?
Yeah. People seem to like it. They seem to like stone mulch, and it just doesn't make any sense from a landscape and an environmental standpoint.
What kind of shrubs are you into right now?
We all shop all over the city here, and I'm going to mention at least one retailer that everybody knows, and that's Costco.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife and I go there once a week to get our supplies of what we want to eat. And all during the summer months in our heat and drought, I don't ever remember seeing any water there getting to these shrubs, and yet they looked absolutely beautiful, and that's Potentilla. I don't think there's any plant tougher on to be able to survive in drought situations than a Potentilla. It's a small, knee-high shrub and has yellow flowers that bloom all summer long, and they're still in bloom now, looking great. So they're the best ones. There's some out there that are a little – there's one out there that's a little bit stronger, and it's the Japanese barberry. But barberries are thorny, and they kind of look a little bit ratty after a while. The Potentilla – doesn't look ratty. I've never seen a ratty-looking Potentilla unless you planted it in too much shade. If it's in too much shade, then it's not going to do very well. So that's probably the best one. And then there's junipers that you can go ahead and buy. They're considered a very, very tough plant as far – once they get established.
Right. There's basically no getting rid of those if you change your mind, right?
Yeah. Well, you can get rid of them. My father-in-law at one time had an old juniper in his yard, and he didn't like it. It had gotten ugly, as some things do when they get older, and he wanted it taken out. And I said, sure, I'll be glad to go ahead and do it. Well, I couldn't dig it out myself, so I had to take my pickup truck, put a chain around it, and get down and yank the thing out.
Yeah,
to get
I know
it out
people
of there.
Have to
so
do
they
it
have
with
roots as
wheelers.
Thick as your arm, you know, to
I
keep
mean,
it anchored in there.
Massive, so
And then one more thing, if we have the time.
Yeah.
I noticed them, and I'm sure a lot of people have. We have our crab apples that bloom, our lilacs that bloom, and they look nice in the early spring. And then it's gone.
Yeah.
When the crab apples are gone and the lilacs are gone, we have this wonderful tree. It's called the Japanese tree lilac, and it has a creamy white flower that you see as you drive along in June. July. And they're perfect for putting under power lines because they get to be about 20, 25 feet tall. So they aren't going to interfere with the power lines coming into your house. They don't have a stink to them that could be distasteful in some of the plants that we can go ahead and grow. They're essentially trouble-free. They have a copper-colored bark to them. Mm-hmm. So they add some good enhancement to the landscape, and they're tough trees.
Okay.
So they're tough. They know their place in the landscape. They don't get big and overpowering like elms, ashes, and maples do. I still love those trees. But in most home landscapes, we don't need trees that big. So if you have a boulevard area or a front yard that you want to go ahead and add some enhancement to, look for the Japanese tree lilac. There are several cultivars out there for you to go ahead and choose from.
I got my workout in this morning doing some seeding in my boulevard, and I decided to go with a no-mow grass, something that just kind of grows up a couple inches and then it sort of falls flat. And I thought, why am I mowing this when I don't need to? But it just about killed me to be raking it and seeding it and covering it back up. And I thought, oh, there's got to be a better way.
Mm-hmm.
Tech advances for seeding, are they out there yet?
I don't have it, but I happened to witness somebody doing it this past year, or this past week, actually. I was out in the state where the owner wanted to have their lawn renovated, and we got a hold of a particular contractor that was very highly recommended. I hadn't met the guy before, so I was acting as a consultant for this person, and so I went out there and I've got to see how this operates. So he had a core plugger, a machine that pulls the plugs, mm-hmm. which we've all had those kicking around for a long time, and I used them when I was younger and working for NDSU full time.
When you see those big divots in
yeah,
the
plugs,
yard.
Yeah, yeah, pulling out. This one pulls out plugs about the size of a well-smoked-down cigar butt.
Okay.
But you don't ever see the plug, and 99% of the plugs are immediately followed up with a shredding. So he goes over, pulls the plugs, and right behind the plugs that are being pulled, they get shredded.
Okay.
All right. And then he comes back with a machine that takes and cuts slits in the soil and the grass and drops seed in those slits there. And you do it in a diamond-shaped fashion. So in other words, if you go north and south, well, you can go east and west if you want. But if you kind of go off on the kitty corner mm-hmm. from, you know, southeast to southwest – or to northwest, mm-hmm. not straight across, you get a good tight canopy coming up. Now, it's good for lawns that are already established. If you're going to be putting in a new lawn, brand new lawn with mm-hmm. seed, it also works that way beautifully because you're getting the seed in contact with the soil. You're not sitting it on top of the soil,
okay.
which the birds will go ahead and ravish. Mm-hmm. They'll love it, and they'll thank mm-hmm. you for it.
Yeah, I think more than planting my boulevard, I think I just fed the turkeys really for winter. So, yeah. Now, that kind of machine, it sounds like the average homeowner really doesn't have any kind of need for it.
I haven't seen them, Ashley, at the rental places, because if they did, they would certainly be bragging about them. And this crew was very well trained, people coming from Mexico. They were legal, and they had uniforms on. They looked like they knew what they were doing, and in fact, they did know what they were doing. They handled their equipment very professionally, and the guy that found these things, I mean, it's a commercial product that you can go ahead and buy. If you have a lot of land you want to do it yourself, I'm sure you can go ahead and buy it out there, and I could find out where they can be purchased if anybody's ever interested in it. But it makes that job, that onerous job of trying mm-hmm. to get seed into the soil to get it to go ahead and germinate and give you a good looking lawn.
Mm-hmm.
This makes it somewhat almost too easy to do. Almost, not quite, but almost. Makes it a heck of a lot easier.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the important thing.
All right. We check in with horticulturist Ron Smith periodically during the growing season. Ron, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure to be here with you. Thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Prairie Public is proud to be the media sponsor of the FM Visual Artists Studio Crawl, October 2nd and 3rd, noon to 6 p.m. See Fargo-Moorhead's artist at work, ask questions, and perhaps be inspired to create your own art. Find a map to begin your tour at prairiepublic.org.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 14th. Two men were executed in North Dakota on this date in 1900. Their cases were unrelated. On March 19th, James Jenkins and his son, Ira, reported that August Stark had frozen to death in a coal mine near Wilton. The father and son were the mine operators and Stark an employee. The victim showed signs of having been dragged to the spot where he was found. When the Jenkins men were separately interviewed, they told contradictory stories, and both were charged with murder. The state's attorney believed it was Ira who killed Stark, and Ira went on trial. His father testified that his son had admitted robbing and killing Stark, but the younger man denied it and accused his father of getting drunk and strangling Stark. But doctors said the body showed no sign of being choked. The jury found Ira guilty, and the judge sentenced him to death. Ira spent his last hours cursing and blaming everyone but himself. As he went to the scaffold, he puffed on a cigar and maintained his innocence. A handwritten note was later found in his pants pocket. In it, Ira admitted his guilt. Almost due north from Wilton, Hans Thorpe climbed to his Minot scaffold, also with a cigar in his teeth. A crowd was on hand to see Thorpe's execution. He had even sent out invitations.
Thorpe came to North Dakota 2 years earlier, in 1898, and ran a store in Minot with his brother. He met and married a pretty teenager named Ida Johnson, but within a year there was trouble. Thorpe was irrationally jealous every time Ida left the house. On December 1st, 1899, Ida went next door to visit a Mrs. Johansson. Thorpe, coming off a week-long bender, followed Ida and shot her in the head as she sat in a rocking chair. He then shot himself, but managed only to destroy his right eye. The doctor who treated him found that Thorpe had third-stage syphilis, a side effect of which was insanity. On May 10th, Judge David Morgan found Thorpe guilty and sentenced him to die in what would be Ward County's first and last legal execution. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas. I'm Director of Radio here at Prairie Public, and I want to thank you, our members, for all your generous support. Your contributions have not only helped keep the lights on, but added extra meaning to the work we do. We're proud to be North Dakota's home for NPR and a trusted source for regional news and quality programming in North Dakota and surrounding regions. We're also grateful to our sponsors in the business community, especially those who were able to stick with us during recent challenging economic times, like Basin Electric Power Cooperative and Urgent Med. I hope you'll get the chance to thank them too. And when you do, tell them you heard about them on Prairie Public.
At the beginning of the pandemic, hospitals were in chaos.
You shout out to somebody, hey, can you check on my other people? Like, I can't even see a monitor. I don't know how they're doing.
Now, a new COVID surge is overwhelming doctors and nurses, and some of them are giving up.
Now that there is a vaccine and people aren't getting it, my sense of duty, it's changed for me. Like, no, I'm not interested anymore.
What it means when healthcare workers burn out on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we get a preview of the upcoming Theodore Roosevelt Symposium. This year's theme, Western Scenes, Western Friends. We visit with two Roosevelt scholars on who were some of the president's most trusted Western advisors. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.